Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we're still, I'll just say we're in the last stretch of the amendments, even though we've still got, let me see, 7, 8 to go. Well, actually, there's a bit more since we have a few unratified amendments. But it is, you know, the most of the rest of these amendments really are just kind of perfunctory. They're things that most people don't care about. That people have been learning a little bit about the 20th Amendment and the 25th Amendment and so forth, because they do have some functions that have now come forth regarding the competency of the president and so forth. So anyway, we've got Paul Venable from Missouri back with us. Paul, when we ran out of time yesterday, I mentioned the sick chicken law, and right. Come to find out, it's actually the sick chicken case. But it's a case that was regarding labor law that I I think you summarized it in the fact that it was allowable for, you know, a company to offer sick chickens, but not to offer a minimum wage.
Right.
And I'm going, correct. Is so bottom line, that was just the, you know, I think it was not an outlier. It was just kind of, I think it was a significant point to say, look, there were all sorts of unsavory labor laws that were coming out. And I think you said that that came out of the Depression. Prior right. to the Depression, and post the creation, as I said, Teddy Roosevelt created the Department of Commerce and Labor. And this is how they started trying to regulate labor in America. Unconstitutionally, folks. Remember, Madison vetoed congressional attempts to regulate the highways, waterways, and so forth. And actually, it wasn't just to regulate. He vetoed their ability to just make improvements, not even regulate, just to make improvements.
Sure.
And
but
so
then he told them, we'll come back with an amendment.
Yeah, give me an amendment. And then Monroe did the same thing. And then Jackson did the same thing. And Jackson even stated, you know, surely the good people of America, if they want you to be able to improve the roads, which benefits them, mm-hmm. then they'll give you the amendment. Go to them and get the amendment.
Hey, I've asked this before. Why didn't they hear this and just do the amendment? What? You know, and so here we are with Roosevelt now. We're in the 20s, and how does he create commerce and labor? What does he do? Just a flick of a pen?
He got Congress to create an act that allowed them, because this is when he was doing trust busting.
So we got to a place where we have a president who
was truly a tyrannical king. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, but he's so highly regarded. You know, I mean, he's on Mount Rushmore. A lot of people think of Teddy Roosevelt as a you know, virile hero, right?
Uh-huh. Because he was perceived as protecting the little man. Now, we had a conversation regarding corporations, you know, wanting to be able to get the federal government to control and regulate them, to actually protect them. Mm-hmm. Teddy Roosevelt was the guy that actually helped do that. What was perceived as him taking them on was actually basically opening the door to assist them.
Hence,
because as soon as the federal government got in there, you should prove me wrong. I mean, so one of the great cases that, you know, because everybody has this just bitter taste in their mouth when they hear of a corporate monopoly. Oh, that's just evil. And I believe I've told you this before. Alcoa is it is the perfect academic case of a monopoly and how a corporate monopoly is the best thing.
Okay.
Why? Because a corporate monopoly without with zero involvement in government. In other words, the only way a monopoly can become evil is when government supports it. Such as our energy industries and those types of things, even though it's not seen as truly a monopoly, it's really an oligarchy because they choose who can control solar energy, wind energy, oil energy, and so forth. And they go after the competitors. It's very similar to tobacco.
Okay.
And so... Alcoa, you want to look this up, Alcoa and how it was attacked by the federal government as a monopoly. All of these corporations that were trying to compete with Alcoa couldn't compete. And they went to the federal government and said, hey, you know, these guys are selling aluminum too cheap. If we go in and we try to mine and process aluminum, it costs us more money then we can afford to operate. We can't compete against these guys. This isn't fair. You have to make them sell their aluminum for more money so that we can go in and compete, because Alcoa had a corner on the market with aluminum. Nobody could touch them. Why? Because every time they improved their profits, or actually say processes, and in turn, increased profits, they lowered their costs to make sure that they didn't have insanely high profits. They were happy.
Really?
Absolutely. They kept on lowering their price as they got better and better and better. So in other words, aluminum became so cheap and so affordable that these guys said, hey, you know, they're making all of these different products because aluminum is now becoming cheaper and cheaper. Bicycles are being made out of them.
So instead of using their own mines and improving their own processes, they use the government as a hammer.
Precisely.
To bang on Alcoa.
Precisely.
Interesting.
Precisely. If you go, folks, just go look at this case and you go, oh my gosh, who's the government really serving?
It's the United States versus Alcoa during the presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Right. And so if you want to know that, you know, monopolies are evil only when the federal government is protecting them. So the oil monopolies are being protected. As a matter of fact, if you really look at it, the oil oligarchy, what we call, you know, the cartel, or, you know, what do they call that, OPEC? You know, these guys are a bunch of criminals. They're gouging. They're basically saying, okay, this is what we're going to sell oil for. We need more profits. And they all agree, because I tell you, there's certain ones that want more profit out of it. And they want, but those types of players, you know, maybe have a greater abundance, and they need the support of the smaller players. The smaller players say, we can't make that kind of profit, or they may need more profit, but nobody's willing to actually oversell their stuff. So in other words, these smaller players are, you know, kind of stuck in getting what they're given, but it's still better than a free market. Because the free market,
better than a free market,
because the free market, they wouldn't be able to compete. The big guys could easily outproduce, you know, and have a marginal cost that would drive these other guys, because smaller markets always have to spend more, you know, because they don't have the economy of scale. You know, the bigger you get, and that's what Alcoa was doing. They had the economy of scale on their side. They had all the different, you know, mining stuff, the manufacturing, the processing. I mean, they were this giant of aluminum.
But they were still, there was still a free market because the government hadn't injected itself into it, right?
So the question is, do we really have a free market in America? No. We have a mercantile system. We do not have a free market system. What's the difference between a mercantile? What is a mercantile system?
That's a good question.
Okay, I'll let you look it up, because this really goes to Adam Smith and the Wealth of Nations. Adam Smith was pointing out the evils of a mercantile system and how it basically works and colludes. Government and corporations work and collude. So remember, I've been talking about this on Fridays regarding the conspiracy that Britain became this huge empire because it really wasn't conspiring with the church like the Catholic Empire, the Roman Catholic Empire. They've been conspiring with corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And the West Indies Company was one of those big evil corporations that they
British
controlled.
East India Company?
What's that?
Right?
What?
The British East India Company.
I thought it was the West Indies Company.
Yeah, British East India. Okay. That's they were.
Okay.
Hang on. Mercantilism was an economic system of trade that spanned 16th to the 18th century, based on the principle that the world's.
So bottom line, a mercantile system is controlled by government. Government comes along and says, this is what you will produce, and you'll produce this much of that.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, when we look at the early days of the framers, they told everybody what they had to produce. They allowed them to produce other things, but what was the one thing that America was producing that was becoming a big benefit, a big boon, and it was actually considered our cash crop?
What period of time was this again?
This was the beginning of the colonies. The framers were, yeah, absolutely, tobacco. Why were they growing tobacco when if everything you read about growing tobacco, it depleted the nutrients of your ground soil, made it hard to grow other things.
But it was so profitable.
And for whom? For whom? Pardon? The framers, the colonists, or for Britain?
Well, tell me.
It was profitable for Britain. Because as more and more, as the demand grew for tobacco, as the demand grew for opium, they made money.
And Britain made money.
Oh, absolutely. Because, you know, they were the ones that were moving all of it. They were the central part. It was a mercantile system. You couldn't just trade it. You had to use them to trade it.
Okay.
So they controlled the system. And so when you look today at our economics and so forth, here's the question. Who ships everything around the world today? Who controls the majority of shipping?
And at this point, I believe China's shipping everything around the world today. Am I mistaken?
So I see it moving away from nations, because who ships everything in the United States today?
Oh, we had this discussion. We had this discussion a few weeks ago. I remember now.
Okay, so
who ships everything in the United States? I don't remember who it was.
So the shift is going to corporations. Corporations is going to control the world.
Right.
So
corporations are shipping.
Folks, we're just around the corner from Amazon actually delivering via a fleet of drones your parcels, what have you.
Mm-hmm.
And so and as a matter of fact, they're even putting out videos to show how easy it will be for you to ship your parcel. You want to use Amazon, you just kind of print, put the label on there, you go outside, the drone will come, and you just have a little hook, you hook it up, and boom, it's gone.
Wow.
Now, let me say this. I had an Amazon delivery, because Amazon is actually trying to divorce themselves from the United States Postal Service. Everywhere where an Amazon distribution system is set up, we should be talking about the Constitution, but everywhere where an Amazon distribution system is set up, they are slowly pulling out of and slowly voiding their relationship with the United States Postal Service. And so, when you print a Amazon label, it is going to stay within the Amazon shipping system. They still use the Postal Service for prime, because the labor force that's there, you know, to do that is hard to replace, but they are eventually going to replace the UPS or USPS. They don't, and they won't use FedEx and or UPS. They are going to become the elite shippers, and in from both picking up as well as delivering.
Wow.
And so we had an Amazon, because we saw this. We had our first parcels actually delivered by a U-Haul truck. And I was standing in front of my house, and I was talking to a person that was working in our front yard. And I said, "Is that your truck?" "No, no. I think they're delivering something." And I had a little bit of time. I had a meeting coming up, and I sort of stood there. 10 minutes later, I realized, you know, hey, this person's not. I have no idea who's there. All I heard was a bunch of rustling in this U-Haul van. Rustle, rustle, rustle. So I yell out, "Hello, are you there?" And yeah, I got some packages for you. And so I said, "Do I need to sign for them?" "No." And I said, "Then just put them on the stoop." And I went back in. I come back out. There's like four or five packages. And
from
I go,
Amazon.
From Amazon. But I go, "You got to be kidding me. This person was on my property trying to sort through all the parcels in that truck." That, you know, this was a big, huge van with no shelves. I mean, it was just, you know, this big shaker that was mixing things up as she was driving along. It was a female. And so anyways, and she got really indignant when I said, "Hello, are you going to deliver something?" "Yeah." And I said, "Well," and I realized, "I got a meeting. I can't stand here and wait for you. Do I have to sign for it?" So that's when we went our separate ways. But here's the bottom line. She delivered four packages that day, and I went out, and there on my footstep, early in the morning or late at night, she came back and delivered another box, which was the one she was looking for. It was so buried in her van that she couldn't do it. And so I'm going, how can Amazon afford to pay that labor?
Right.
I mean, for the 15 minutes to deliver that one person just on this one little part of the shipping cost them that much money on the labor.
Have you seen the Amazon trucks, though?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It's. I have a friend that worked for Amazon, and that had to be an anomaly, especially because they used a U-Haul. Because incidentally, Amazon monitors their drivers electronically.
Sure.
If you step on the gas too fast, you're going to get dinged. Okay. So they really have this down to a science. And I think it was just unusual. This woman had to deliver her stuff in a U-Haul because maybe they had a lot of packages that day. That's unusual.
Yeah. You know, so they're slowly maturing out here. And,
right.
And I'm telling you, Amazon is not your friend, folks. If you haven't already heard, they are cheap on their labor. They're crushing us. And everybody, I mean, if you, corporations, you know, only care, it's the same thing with, they're almost like communist countries.
Mm-hmm.
They only care about what they center their heart and soul about. They don't care about the people. As we start losing our soul in business and everything else, because that's their model. Anyway, let's get on to the 20th Amendment.
Okay, here we are. Proposed
32. No. The unratified article, because we never did this.
I'm sorry.
One. 1926.
Okay. Proposed 1926 and unratified. Section 1, the Congress shall have power to limit, regulate, and prohibit the labor of persons under 18 years of age. Section 2, the power of the several states is unimpaired by this article, except that the operation of state laws shall be suspended to the extent necessary to give effect to legislation enacted by the Congress. I had never heard of this until just now.
Yeah.
So Congress wanted power over labor. This is 1926. This is even before the Great Depression.
Correct. Okay. And Calvin Coolidge was the champion. Yep. Calvin Coolidge was the champion. He was a huge labor advocate.
Okay. And so what was the driver for prohibiting labor of persons under 18 years of age? Was it the perception this had something to do with the child labor laws, right?
Yes, it sure did.
Or child labor. And so I guess there was a perception that there was abuse being done by child labor. That's the only reason I can imagine.
Okay, so child labor was, let's look at the history of America.
Mm-hmm.
Were there large corporations in America when it was founded? No. But there was a lot of child labor. As a matter of fact, labor, family labor, made the family, it helped the family survive.
Correct.
Teaching the children your trade, teaching the children, you know, what to do, how to grow the food, how to build this, or whatever it was that was your profession, it was shared with the family. And so one of the reasons why they had big families back then is to help the family survive better. Everybody Correct. Contributed. And so when mom and dad, you know, were getting too old to run the farm, they would leave it to either a son or a couple of their children. And
right.
Go ahead.
There was something else about that because I've seen it in my family. The children took care of mom and dad.
Yes.
When they were older.
Yes. It was, the family was, you know, integral to survival.
Right. It was the economic unit of the time.
Right. And remember, so I pointed this out in that English song, Jerusalem, where the poet actually points to the soulless evil mills of, you know, these terrible mills that were standing up, the factories in the early 1800s, because flour was being ground by, you know, individuals. And as a farm actually started becoming very proficient in grounding in their processes because they made machinery that did it better. And as they were doing that, then, you know, instead of the farmer actually having their stuff milled by hand, they would, you know, take it to the person that had the machine, and that person would just charge them at a fraction of what the labor would cost for that other person. And right. eventually they became professional milling, you know, right. and those types of services that started, you know, basically coming up out of the farms and out of the agrarian society. Mm-hmm. So factories were, you know, farms begot factories, just like all other labor or all other productions, shoes, clothes, every, you know, the things we used ended up, you know, creating this thing called a factory. And right. so we saw that the labor was shifting away from the family in the home into companies and corporations.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of speaks to that, like I said, that song in Jerusalem of these, you know, these evil mills, these evil factories that were rising in Britain. That was the early 1800s, and that's what we started seeing here, where Americans, you know, moved away from the family farms and moved away from, and kids started finding, you know, hey, life's a little better when I go work at a factory, I get smart, and all of the opportunities. It was
right.
with these new factories, it created the advent of the Industrial Revolution created a new wild, wild west. And then the next evolution in business and so forth, whether it be banking, whether it be computers, what have you, expands that wild, wild west of opportunities. Now, we're going to go into a break. So when we come back, we'll actually get back into this labor law of why the paradigm was beginning to shift and why we saw this labor law actually, you know, become the righteous thing of the indignation of progressives. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance.
In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416. Okay, so when we start looking at the Communist Revolution at the very beginning with Engels and the Communist Manifesto, I mean, Marx and Engels have already pointed their finger of judgment at, you know, the families and how, you know, the government needed to take over because the families were cruel in this slave labor of, you know, making their kids work for them, you know, and so forth. They also looked at the mills and the corporations as equally evil because they were profit-based. Now, mm-hmm. Let's look at the communist-ran corporations. How righteous or how well did people thrive in communist countries with their manufacturing and so forth? I mean, everybody was poor, and it seemed like communism was failing because people saw, you know, its belly button. They saw its, you know, its vulnerable core, that it did not care about individuals. It only cared about control. Mm-hmm. And so as this amendment was coming forward, communism, if you follow any of the exposing of progressivism and communism in America, it became this really bright, you know, wow, communism seems great. It's like this perfect society. You know, Russia just had its revolution, and look, Russia, you know, seems to be thriving. At least Dewey and a lot of intellectuals were literally criticizing America in how backwards we were. Look at how we treat our children.
Okay, but that's the point. How we treat our children, having them work. I mean,
at that point, they were working in the farm. So now they wanted to actually create regulations not to. See, look at kids today. Are kids working? This is the fruit of what they were trying to do in the 1920s. They wanted to make kids, enable them to be entitled, mm-hmm. and make them so that they're worthless.
So what one of the most valuable things I'm grateful to my parents for is that I learned how to work early. Uh-huh. And I think it's something that, you know, the fact that here they wanted to prohibit the labor of persons under 18 years of age, that actually takes from the family, you know, the opportunity for the children to bring value, you know, financial value to the family, because the family was an economic unit. And so this didn't pass. I think, you know, commerce and labor, you know, that Roosevelt, you know, that Teddy Roosevelt did, you know, continue to do this work, but at least, how should I put this? At least Coolidge wanted to do an amendment. He knew the process.
Correct.
He may have been a progressive, but he also understood the process.
Correct. And he guarded it and followed it. Mm-hmm. Right? He wasn't going to allow Congress to just create a bill to do it. He said the only way we can do this is this way. So what they did was they tried, and this is how they exposed themselves. Folks, they only were seeking an amendment to legitimize what they wanted to do. Did mm-hmm. they get the amendment? No.
No.
So where in the Constitution, because they've already exposed the fact that they needed this, Coolidge had already played that card. I don't think, as much as Coolidge loved organized labor and collective labor, so this flies in the face of everybody that tells you Coolidge was a conservative. So based on my paradigm of a conservative, that means that we are limited government. But no, that's not true. A conservative is somebody that has the social values of a, you know, of a person, you know, a religious person or what have you, to where they are, you know, not killing people, not, you know, promoting, you know, immorality and those types of things. That's the conservative side. It has nothing to do with government overreach. And so this is why I tell people that, you know, conservative is not constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
Conservative is just as much an enemy to our Constitution as a liberal is. Believe it or not, they may be just more moral. They may be more palatable because, oh, well, at least they're not teaching our children to, you know, to pervert themselves and those types of things. But they still want control over our children.
Mm-hmm.
Unconstitutionally. So anyway, now we hit the 20th Amendment, and now this is kind of interesting. So,
okay, this is interesting. So here we go. Proposed in 32 and ratified in 33.
Uh-huh.
Okay, Article 20. Section 1, the terms of the president and vice president shall end at noon on the 20th day of January. Now, before it had been March. Now it's January. And the terms of senators and representatives at noon on the third day of January of the years in which such terms would have ended if this article had not been ratified, and the terms of their successors shall then begin.
Keep going.
The Congress shall assemble at least once in every year, and such meetings shall begin at noon on the third day of January, unless they shall by law appoint a different day.
Okay.
Okay.
Keep going.
You want to go on?
Mm-hmm.
All right. If at the time fixed for the beginning of the term of the president-elect shall have died, the vice president-elect shall become president. If a president shall not have been chosen for the time fixed for the beginning of his term, or if the president-elect shall have failed to qualify, then the vice president-elect shall act as president until a president shall have qualified. And the Congress may by law provide for the case when neither a president-elect nor a vice president-elect shall have qualified, declaring who shall then act as president, or the manner in which one who is to act shall be selected, and such person shall act accordingly until a president or a vice president shall have qualified. Can I stop here for a minute?
Absolutely. This is where I want you to stop.
Okay. All right. So the
look at the year it was proposed.
Okay, 32 and 33. Mm-hmm. Now, this was during
Hoover.
The Roosevelt. Hoover. It was during Hoover.
So when did Hoover get elected?
Let's see. Herbert Hoover.
Well, we know the Coolidge was in 26.
Oh, yeah, Coolidge was in 26, and he did not run for mm-hmm. re-election. So Hoover had to have been elected in 30. And took office in 31.
No, no, no.
Right?
No.
Right.
It was an off year. It was an off year.
It was an off year. So he would have been elected in 32.
In 28. Hoover was elected in 28.
In 28.
So the depression, the crash of the market didn't happen on Coolidge's watch.
Correct. It didn't. It happened in 29.
Okay.
Okay.
So in other words, Hoover was elected in 28. Mm-hmm. And again, everybody points to, well, Hoover was a Republican. No, Hoover was a progressive. He mm-hmm. was a huge progressive. As a matter of fact, he happened to be, I believe, the Secretary of the Treasury at the time Wilson, I mean, look up Hoover with Wiki and look at his career while I'm talking about this, because I think you're going to find Hoover actually was a part of the Wilson administration. You should also find out that on Hoover's own accord, he actually wrote a loving biography of Woodrow Wilson that, you know, actually speaks. I mean, so when you read this biography that he wrote, here Hoover is absolutely warmly supporting the great things that Woodrow Wilson did. And so when Wilson ended up dying, and while Harding was president in 1920, we had a downturn. We actually had a crash in the market. And Hoover, because this was the first time the Fed Reserve had just been created, this was the first time that the Fed Reserve had the opportunity to play its games with the market by allowing the federal government to basically print money and basically pump it into the market at that point. So Hoover goes to Harding and says, hey, we need to react. We need to respond. We need to print and pump money into the market. And Harding looked at him and goes, are you kidding? Why? And he goes, well, this is why. And he says, okay, well, let me think about that. And he basically dismissed Hoover. Well, within 6 months, you know, things kind of, you know, Harding was just watching. And within 6 months, everything started correcting itself. But within 6 months, things were back to normal. And Harding came along and says, you know, I remember it was just 6 months ago when you came to me and said, oh, we got to do this. And I'm really glad we didn't, because everything worked out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Harding was, you know, he was a terrible man. He should never, he himself uttered the words, he should never be president. But anyway, I mean, he was the one.
He said that of himself?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. He said that he was not fit to be a president. And he ended up dying in office. But nevertheless, Hoover then ended up getting dismissed, and he was no longer. You got him up there on Wiki?
I do.
Okay, so go ahead and cover his career.
Let me back up some. Here's one, director of the United States Food Administration in 1917. This office was established and he created by Woodrow Wilson, and he was appointed director. Okay. No one followed him. This office was abolished, and then he became the U.S. Secretary of Commerce under Harding.
Okay, my bad. I thought it was the Treasury, but okay. Under Harding. Harding put him up there. But he was a part of the Woodrow Wilson administration. Okay. Go ahead.
Right. He started in the Woodrow Wilson administration, and then Harding became president. He was a Secretary of Commerce. Remember this new organization. And then from there, he went to being 28. Okay, and then he must have become president from there, because he served from 29 to 33. Right?
Right. Okay, so what we see is that he kind of went away after Harding kind of looked and said, you know, I'm not buying what you're selling. So he was no longer in the administration. Then he ran for president.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Was he in office?
It wasn't that long, because he was in office till August 21 and 1928, and 1928 was an election year.
Uh-huh.
So he must have been a candidate for president after leaving the Harding administration.
Right. Well, so I have no idea how it all played out.
Yeah.
Because I know that in those days, the party bosses kind of controlled everything. But nevertheless, now we're looking at this amendment. The whole point of this is, who was in office at this time? and who was running against Hoover.
Mm-hmm. Let's see, who was running
against Hoover? In 1932, who became elected in 1932? FDR.
Oh, sure.
So now you're looking at an amendment that was really focused on the survivability of the president. Right?
Okay.
If at the time fixed for the beginning of the term of the president-elect shall have died, mm-hmm. the vice president shall become president. If a president shall not have been chosen, and so forth and so on. So anyway, this amendment was kind of like setting the stage and helping create a public relations campaign. Why were we looking at this issue at this time in an election year?
So let me ask you a question. Was Roosevelt's health not well at the time? I'm just curious. Roosevelt.
Yes, Roosevelt had polio. Most people didn't know that, but they played nice. And instead of saying, hey, this guy's wheelchair bound and everything else, the American people didn't know much about Roosevelt's health. Mm-hmm. But the reality was that Hoover knew that he needed to create a perception. And so that perception went out to the state legislatures because they're the ones that amended the Constitution to do this. So he was hoping that they would actually kind of lay it out there that, you know, hey, even if you elect FDR, you may not get FDR as the president.
Okay. So, and Hoover was behind this?
Yes. He was in office at the time.
Okay, sure. Sure, he was in office at the time. So, this raises so many questions. Hoover is in office at the time. He knows Roosevelt is coming. It just opens up so many questions that maybe this isn't, you know, the time for that.
Well, so I'm gonna put it out there because this kind of goes in line with the conspiracy and everything else. Eleanor Roosevelt. It was later disclosed via the Venona Project and so forth that there was a KGB operative by the name of Eleanor that was in the DC circle. And so in the middle of the Cold War going into World War II, mm-hmm. Russia had sent a lot of KGB agents. And so FDR created this project called the Venona Project, and it was investigating banking and all of these different things to find out who these KGB agents were in the United States operating. Mm-hmm. And as they came down to identifying, many of them had code names, and there was a good percentage, not a lot, but a good percentage of them that didn't have code names. And they started realizing because they go, well, who's, you know, here's a name, but who is that? And then they realize that's actually that person's name. Mm-hmm. One of the names that they hadn't actually found that was presented to FDR. Now, mm-hmm. I don't have any documentation other than the fact that when I went to the NSA museum, a curator who was an employee back in the 50s at the NSA museum basically stated this. And the paperwork on the Venona Project, as it got unclassified, you know, kind of helped things open up. But basically, he said that the name Eleanor was on that list when FDR saw that list. And that's mm-hmm. when he closed the Venona Project down.
Hmm. Interesting.
Now, dead air for effect. Because
right.
they started really discovering, you know, who was injected into America and into American politics, it was finally being disclosed. I mean, so here's the question. Was the intelligence agency at that point compromised? But was the NSA in its inception compromised? Or were these people true patriots that were really trying to get to the bottom of something?
was the NSA way back then in the thirties, uh-huh. early thirties?
Uh-huh. Okay. Not early, mid thirties, I believe.
Okay.
Okay, so
I don't know the answer. I believe that many of our federal agencies are compromised, so it wouldn't surprise me that
I believe that the politicians were compromised. I believe the agencies weren't. At that point in time, I don't believe the NSA was. I believe that they were really trying to do the right thing. They were getting ready to expose Eleanor.
And he closed
the program.
Program.
Bill Clinton did something very similar to what we call Able Danger.
Mm-hmm.
Able Danger was a program that was ran by the Pentagon. It was data mining. Mm-hmm. And this is where they started exposing some things. And as soon as Clinton realized that they got too close to information that, you know, would have created the connections necessary to their involvement, he closed it down.
Okay.
Look that up. Google that. So anyway, moving on. So what's really important is that this whole amendment was created to tip off America that, you know, in the case that we actually may be fooled into electing somebody that has real health issues, this is what's going to happen. If they die while they're in office or before they can get to office, right?
Okay. All right. So that also moved. They also moved the term starting from March to January.
Right. The swearing in becomes. I believe was it on here the 20th? Yeah, the 20th day of January is when the president gets sworn in.
Yep. Now. There's something else here. It's not specified in the Constitution, but it does specify that Congress, if a president or president are unable to serve, it specifies that Congress gets to determine how that happens, what the line of succession is until a president and or vice president can be selected.
Right.
Okay. And so I think that current line of succession is Speaker of the House, then, you know, Speaker pro tem of the Senate or President pro tem of the Senate. And I don't know where it goes after that. But, okay. Interesting.
Uh-huh. Okay. Mm. And then the fifth section.
Sections 1 and 2 shall take effect on the 15th day of October following the ratification of this article,
right,
which only took a year. This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of 3/4 of several states within 7 years from the date of its submission. So that's Article 20.
Okay. Now 21.
Okay.
Proposed and ratified in 33.
Right. That was fast. The 18th article of amendment to the Constitution of the United States is hereby repealed. The transportation or importation into any state, territory, or possession of the United States for delivery or use therein of intoxicating liquors in violation of the laws thereof is hereby prohibited. This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as amendments to the Constitution by conventions of the several states as provided in the Constitution within 7 years from the date of the submission hereof to the states by the Congress. Now, let's see. The article was repealed, but it continued to make.
So, in other words, they put an expiration on the repealing as well, right? That's an expiration. Section 3 is an expiration. This article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by conventions in the several states, as provided in the Constitution, within the 7 years date from the submission hereof to the states by Congress. So in other words, they had a clock, 7 years.
Right.
Okay.
Okay. But Section 2, it looks like that they retained some of it because it still says the transportation or importation in any state, territory, or possession for delivery or use therein of intoxicating liquors in violation of the laws thereof is hereby prohibited. transportation is. So states made laws, okay, and so it still prohibits it. It doesn't prohibit the making, but it prohibits the transportation or importation in violation of the law.
Yeah, and you know why, right? Because the federal government at this point in time was getting a they were getting a good rap because they were allowing the Indian territories to have, you know, all the flowing of alcohol. In other words, it was a scourge to the Indian tribes, the territory, right? Okay. Into any state, right, or state territory or possession of the United States for delivery or use therein of intoxicating liquors. Yeah. So,
okay.
So I think that this was basically saying that they still wanted to have control over what was being sent in. And I don't know. I mean, I don't know if this was a for, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's always sold as, oh, well, we're doing this for the, you know, for the children. We're doing this so that everybody's better off. It's always it's always sold as the good intent. However, you know, it is the iron fist within that velvet glove that does the harm.
Right. Okay.
So,
hey,
go ahead. We're now on the 22nd.
We are on the 22nd Amendment, which is, here we go.
Okay, go ahead.
No person shall be elected to the office of the president more than twice, and no person who has held the office of president or acted as president for more than 2 years of a term to which some other person was elected president shall be elected to the office of the president more than once. But this article shall not apply to any person holding the office of president when this article was proposed by the Congress, and shall not prevent any person who may be holding the office of president or acting as president during the term within which this article becomes operative from holding the office of president or acting as president during the remainder of such term. This was proposed in 47, ratified in 51, and I think after Roosevelt had a third term, right?
Yep.
They decided to do this.
Never again. Right.
Yeah. Section 2, this article shall be inoperative unless it shall have been, here's the, you know, the expiration clause again.
Right.
Unless it shall have been ratified as an amendment to the Constitution by the legislatures of 3/4 of the several states within 7 years from the date of its submission to the states by the Congress.
So as we kind of turn the corner from the progressive amendments of the 17th and 16th, the rest of these are really, like I said, kind of perfunctory. Mm-hmm. You know, they really don't deal with the rights of the people. It's just, we're going to change the process. We're not going to allow a president to be there. Okay, so now we have the 23rd Amendment, proposed in 1960 and ratified in 1961. And actually, because we're out of time, I had no idea. I wasn't even watching it. We'll have to cover the 18th or the 23rd Amendment when we come back. So sorry about that, folks. Sorry about that, Paul. We just ran out of time. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our Constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, health care, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.